that's really nice. I feel a little bit kind of more in relationship to you all now. And it's just really nice to be here, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to give a talk. So thanks to Vajradevi and the centre. I've also, kind of think it's a really great idea to have a theme for the year, and like I've really noticed that there's momentum building at the centre in relation to that. I've been to a few events with the Kalyanamitra theme, and it just feels like a really unifying force in a way. So thanks very much for that. And I wasn't quite sure who I was going to be speaking to, so I think a lot of people have worked in team-based right livelihood, some people haven't. So I just hope, you'll get something from this talk. It's not so easy to talk about Kalyanamitra and team-based right livelihood, I found out. So I think my talk is a bit more broad brushstrokes than kind of the details. And anybody who's worked with me in team-based right livelihood who wants to correct anything, please feel free. So, Kalyanamitra, if you've been to other talks at the centre, or if you're aware of what Kalyanamitra is, it's basically the Sanskrit term for spiritual friendship. So Kalyana means beautiful and good. And Mitra, as you may well be aware, especially if you're a Mitra, means friend. So it's beautiful and good friendship. It's beautiful and good because it's in the context of our spiritual practice. And so it's often just termed spiritual friendship. And that's to kind of really distinguish it from ordinary friendship. So, and you've probably heard this story many, many times as well, of the Buddha's conversation with Ananda. The Buddha actually admonishes Ananda when Ananda suggests to the Buddha that Kalyanamitra is half of the spiritual life. And the Buddha replies to Ananda, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. Kalyanamitra is the whole of the spiritual life." So the Buddha has given Kalyanamitra, or spiritual friendship, a very important place in the spiritual life. In saying that, he's saying it's not just an aside to practice. It's implied that Kalyanamitra can take us all the way to enlightenment. So with these words from the Buddha in mind, I just thought it was really interesting when I was reading Subhuti on Kalyanamitra, that he says, and this is a quote from Subhuti, "Without Kalyanamitra running through our movement, it simply becomes an organisation. Our movement really is Kalyanamitra. The organisational framework is simply there to facilitate Kalyanamitra." So without Kalyanamitra, the Triratna movement could just be a Buddhist organisation. And I think this is what Bhante came up against when he came back to the UK, in the late 60s with, the Mahabodhi Society, that he felt like it was a very well-run Buddhist society, but it was definitely lacking something. So we could be a Buddhist organisation, we could be very effective, in teaching the Dharma, running activities, in our fundraising. But I have the feeling from what the Buddha and Subhuti are saying is that it would lack aliveness. So it would be a functioning body. Triratna could just be a functioning body. It would lack the transformative element that gives depth and breadth to spiritual life. So we would have a movement, but I think for me, we'd have no magic. Yeah. It would lack the beauty that permeates our connections. So, I think there is something really beautiful and magical in our practice together. And I think we can achieve a lot more together than we can on our own. So, what makes this spiritual friendship, this Kalyanamitra, so beautiful and good? What I understand the reason for this is that in spiritual friendship, we're relating on the basis of our going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And this has a profound effect on our connections with one another. So hopefully this connection transforms our ordinary experience into one that is more and more geared towards the transcendental perspective. So that's a perspective beyond the limits of our ego identity, the transcendental perspective. For me, that always kind of conjures up the idea of bringing more magic into our lives by putting the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha at the centre of our lives. It means we make choices and commitments that orient ourselves towards the beautiful and the good. So it makes sense to see that kind of permeating our Buddhist centres, and that would be happening on retreat, and maybe in our time spent together, catching up with each other, having coffee. But what about our working life? Why not bring that beauty and goodness of connection into our working life? It just seems like a no-brainer in a way, doesn't it? So just as our movement without Kalyanamitrata is just an organisation, I think the same applies to team-based right livelihood. Without Kalyanamitrata, our business is just a business. So its procedures, its rules, its positions, its policies, its pay rates, as Amaya well knows. There's no magic, not much transformation, and no movement towards enlightenment. So I wasn't sure who I was talking to, so I just thought I'd backtrack and just say that team-based bright livelihood, besides being a mouthful, is a Tri Ratna term for the Buddhist businesses that are operated by members of the Tri Ratna Sangha. And as Vajradevi said, I work at Windhorse Evolution, which is one of the largest and longest running of these businesses. So just to break that down a little bit, right livelihood is one of the limbs of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. And how one engages in their livelihood was obviously very important to the Buddha 2,500 years ago. It must have been important for him to make it one of the eight limbs of the Noble Eightfold Path. So he saw it as our livelihood being one of the areas in our life that, through practice, could lead us from suffering towards enlightenment. And our livelihoods, how we support ourselves, how we make our living. And the Buddha was recognizing that aspect of our life, a very, very, I think, very concrete aspect of our life. But he was recognizing it as an area where we create karma that can either help or hinder us in our ethical and spiritual life. So I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this, but I think it's Vanija Sutta. The Buddha, in that sutta, the Buddha outlined five areas of work that should not be engaged in. So in other sutras, lots of areas of work are outlined that you shouldn't really consider, or that the Buddha considered unethical. But these five areas of work are basically quite gross breaches of the precepts. So he said business in weapons, business in human beings, business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poisons. These are the five types of businesses that a lay follower should not engage in. So it's really kind of just, I think what I wanted to point out was that right livelihood is very much concerned with ethics and practicing the precepts in our work. There, I think the Buddha was pointing out some very gross examples there. So that's a little bit about right livelihood. In Tri Ratna, we've added the team-based part to that traditional teaching. So the term really refers to the businesses and teams that our movement has set up as a way to work together as Sangha, a way to find ethical, meaningful work and to deepen our going for refuge in this aspect of our lives. It's an aspect that takes up a lot of time in our lives. If we're working full time, it's taking up a third of our day. When you think that a third of it, the other third of it, maybe we sleep. It's a lot of time. So Ratna Ghosha gave a talk in 1998. In which he says that Sangharachita has emphasised from the start the social aspect of right livelihood. And by that he meant the transformative power of right livelihood in society, the transformation of society. So Ratna Ghosha goes on to say that out of this emphasis there grew the phenomenon of the team-based right livelihood business. So It's possible to practice right livelihood without the team-based right livelihood businesses, but team-based right livelihood is a particularly intense and effective form of practice. So in FWBO, or Tree Ratna, we have developed our own situations in which we can practice and fully explore the Buddha's teaching of right livelihood. And I can certainly testify to the truth of Ratnagosha's statement in that it is a very intense and effective form of practice. But I'll talk a little bit more about that later. I'm getting a few nods around there. Okay. So just going back, the Buddha was really clear in his statement to Ananda and including right livelihood in the Noble Eightfold Path, that both Kalyanamitratā and right livelihood are both very, very important aspects of the spiritual life. And in thinking about this talk, I've also found it really interesting that Bhante also thinks both areas are very, very, very important in our spiritual lives, and especially to Tree Ratna. So in fact, both Kalyanamitratā and team-based right livelihood are two of the six distinctive emphases of the Tree Ratna movement. And Bhante gave a talk in 2002 outlining six distinctive emphases, which I'm not going to go through now, but it is a good talk if you haven't heard it before, and you could find out what is distinctive about Tree Ratna. But he made that very, very clear. I've never looked Tree Ratna up on Wikipedia before, and I was looking something up, and all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, there we are on Wikipedia. And, you know, I had to scroll down to see what was there. And they actually do have the six emphases on there. They phrased as teamwork, working together in teams in the spirit of generosity and with a focus on ethics is considered a transformative spiritual practice. Is what it said. And then it said spiritual friendship, creating sangha and connections to deepen our going for refuge. So I don't know why that made me kind of just like, oh, there we are. We really exist. Anyway, just wanting to emphasize that these two areas of our life and practice, Bhante felt very, very, very important to include in our tradition, in our movement, you know, kind of so important that he really wanted to emphasize them. And even more important that he wanted to, and people wanted to set up ways to explore them in the movement. So I just want to say that right livelihood, working in teams, friendship, these things are not exclusive to Tree Ratna. Okay, so I'm just aware that sometimes these terms are used a bit too narrowly to imply that these things only happen in team-based right livelihood situations, so I just want to be really, really clear about that. I'm aware that many, many people are engaged in work that is ethical and positive and altruistic and is right livelihood in the Buddhist sense. It's work that doesn't exploit others, it doesn't harm them, it doesn't cheat them. It may even be work that's very, very, very explicitly there to help others. And people can, you know, definitely follow the precepts in their work. So, you know, there's no exclusivity on right livelihood when I'm talking about team-based right livelihood. We also can't claim an exclusivity on teams. Most workplaces these days, you know, are organised in teams. Teamwork's, you know, something that businesses invest time and money in because they're aware that they're an effective way to work. You know, team building exercises and team building events are kind of held quite highly and can help with productivity, morale, and they, you know, can give the opportunity to utilise more skills of each team member. So, you know, no monopoly on teams. Teamwork is, you know, pretty much part of our society. And just in case anybody was wondering, friendship is also not exclusive to Tree Ratna. You know, and it's not only in team-based right livelihood that we have friendships at work. Okay, so although these areas aren't exclusive to Tree Ratna, you know, kind of one asks the question, so what's the purpose of team-based right livelihood? And why does Bhante give them so much emphasis? So in this talk in 2002 on the six distinctive emphases of the movement, Bante also talked about four essential features of team-based right livelihood. So he said that team-based right livelihood should run on ethical lines. It should provide sufficient financial support to meet reasonable living requirements for a simple life. They should make a profit. We're trying. And that they should be a framework for spiritual practice and especially for spiritual friendship, helping to deepen our going for refuge. So for me, really, this is the dimension that I feel really fortunate to be able to bring very explicitly to my work and in connection with my work colleagues, that we relate on the basis of our spiritual practice, that we relate on the basis of the precepts, and that we have a shared goal in helping each other on the spiritual path. And I think that's something you may not really find in other workplaces. So it's explicit. We are working to grow spiritually, and the work is the context. So without this aspect, we are just another business. So we may be a good business, an ethical business, but that spark's not there, and we're not alive spiritually. Just to go back in time a little bit, team-based right livelihoods initially got set up as people in the early movement went on retreat and began to experience the benefits of practicing together. They realised that they wanted to carry the intensive retreat experience into other areas of their lives. And so they set about doing that, set about setting up communities and setting up businesses to do that. And they've done that very, very successfully. So those conditions that they set up were to help them more effectively kind of take their practice into those aspects of their life and go for refuge and share the practice with each other. I feel really, really fortunate to be part of that. It's many, many years on, 40 years on or whatever, and I feel like I'm part of a lineage and part of the legacy of those conditions being set up. And at the moment, I'm working really hard to try and make sure that we can continue to have those conditions for people to practice in, mainly because I feel like I've just benefited so much. So just moving on from that, I just wanted to explore a few areas that are kind of significant to me in relation to how we kind of share our practice and go for refuge together in the team-based right livelihood situation. So the first thing I thought was that really it's a very, very strong experience of Sangha. It's a very strong practice of Sangha. I know for myself that when I first came to work in evolution, the Buddha and the Dharma jewels were quite firm in me. They were quite strong. I knew kind of that, I didn't really doubt so much the Buddha's teaching, and I didn't doubt the example of the Buddha, but wasn't so sure about the Sangha, wasn't so sure about that aspect of things. And then suddenly I was just completely immersed in the Sangha. I was living in a community. I was working in team-based right livelihood. Dan might be able to tell us a little bit more about that at the moment. All of a sudden, I was, kind of with the Sangha all day, all night, all week, on the weekend, surrounding all these people, kind of like intent on intensive practice. It was very, very, very different to, just coming to the Buddhist Center and going to a class and then just going home again to my habits and my ways of doing things at home. In a way, it felt like there was nowhere to hide. And I often felt very exposed. And I think what was being exposed were my views and my habits, my habitual ways of relating. So, other people think differently to me. They don't necessarily like the same things as me. They don't think my ideas are the best ideas. How could it be so? There are misunderstandings, there are the hurts. The situation was very intensive, mainly because I couldn't run away. Well, I could have left, but, I couldn't run away. So I was, the thought just came to me that in team-based right livelihood, you're kind of held captive to your, you know, your habits. And, you know, back then we used to talk about mirroring a lot. You know, either the situation would be mirroring you or your spiritual friends would be mirroring you, which is really not easy and not comfortable. And, you know, kind of, I suppose for me the tendency would be to blame out or to kind of project out, I think. But when you're in a Sangha situation, from an ethical point of view, that becomes much, much, much more sensitive. And it's much more difficult to kind of see, you know, allow that to happen. So I think slowly, slowly, I began to see through that to some degree and to take more responsibility for my own mental states. But I think also when other people are involved, there's obviously a lot more opportunity to practice metta, to practice tolerance, to take others in as they are, to really look at your views, the views that you haven't really questioned, and to take responsibility for those things. And I think that the conclusion I kind of came to writing this is without being open to other people, it's very, very difficult to experience friendship. So in that intensive, hothouse, intense situation where I couldn't run away and my views were exposed, you know, it's kind of, you know, it opened me up to having to relate to other people, even with all that, you know, seeming baggage in a way, and to work through those, and hopefully to kind of refine those as well. So I think it's kind of being open. That's really what that situation has given me, to seeing that other people have as much to give as perhaps, you know, kind of I do, or as much say as I do, or better ideas than I do, you know, kind of, and that's sharing in that. I kind of read Crime and Punishment a little while ago. And, you know, it's lots of history about the Russian kind of revolution and conditions in Russia at the time. But the only thing I could think of reading this book was the main character who decided to murder somebody, you know, to see kind of ethically where that would, what that would be like, you know, kind of as a thing to do. He had all these friends, all these people knocking on his door and taking care of him, and his mother and his sister and his best mate and this woman who he fell in love with, and everybody was just trying to help him. But he was so stuck in the state he was in, and so much in this kind of, you know, kind of very selfish state. He wasn't aware of the effect he was having on other people. And I was reading the book going, you idiot! You know, all these people are trying to help you. It could be so much easier. But I think I can recognise myself in that main character, not seeing kind of or opening up to the help and the connections that are there around you. And sometimes it just takes time and, you know, kind of practice some good friends to be able to do that. So, the Sangha I find a particularly challenging practice. You know, part of opening up means taking risks in the Sangha, like to go beyond our habitual selves. You really need to take risks. So I find it much easier to take risks in a safe environment. And the Evolution Store in particular and Windhorse have always been fairly safe environments for me. I think because I know underlying those situations is the Dharma, you know, and that's, we can come back to the Dharma. And even if we're not really relating on kind of that level of things, you know, we will somehow find a way to kind of relate on a deeper level. It won't stay superficial. So, yeah, you build trust by taking risks. The other thing I was thinking about is that we it's easier to bring all of ourselves into that situation rather than just the bits you like or the bits you want to present to people. So, you know, you kind of, like, bring all of yourself and, you know, people will see all of that, which can be quite a strong experience of being accepted. If people, you've got all your kind of the bits you don't want people to be kind of seeing, and they see them and they still kind of like you and it's still okay, you know, that's quite a gift, really. So I think the kind of the team situation, for me in evolution, was definitely held by the kind friendship of those more experienced. So that kind of helped me to slowly kind of open up to my views and the habits that were really holding me back from going deeper in practice. So a big part of deepening going for refuge in the Tri Ratna movement is actually getting to know the movement and the order. I think to take our practice deeper, we need faith that we're on the right path and that we can trust the path. So if we're attracted to the Dharma as taught by Bhante, then we need to feel really confident in that. So we can definitely read books and attend classes and be inspired by all of that. But I found really that working with people more committed and experienced in practice really, really gave me faith and confidence in the path and the Dharma as presented by Bhante. It was because I could see those people in the triumphs and struggles of their practice on a daily basis, rather than just being able to see them as a teacher or an order member. I definitely witnessed the reality of people putting the Dharma into practice in their life. I found it really very, very human, very grounding. It shattered the illusion of some perfect kind of order member or some perfect kind of spiritual life. I think it really helped me to see how we can bring our practice into a daily kind of concrete, kind of basically into our lives, not the ideal of our lives. So, I've always found it really inspiring to see people just tackling the mundane duties of perhaps, say, running a shop day in, day out as spiritual warriors, not on the mundane level. So, in a way, kind of like the chopping wood and carrying water of the spiritual life. It's all still there, but it's, how we're approaching it. The opportunity to share in the lives of the other people I was working with on a very fundamental basis, day to day, I just found, I think about it, it's just a really generous thing to do. And I'm thinking of my early times in the shop, which Dattishvari will remember very, very well. When Dattishvari and I were in the Evolution shop 13 years ago was when I arrived, we just had many really, really wonderful Dhammacharinis who were working in the shop. Shantasiddhi, Tejasvini, Guya Prabha, Nagashuri, Kamajoti, have I missed anybody? Oh, Padmashuri. Wow. Wow. They were the people I worked with every day. And I got to know through working with them, and who gave their time and their energy and their metta to me just so very, very generously. And they all really inspired me and remain quite special to me, really, which is why it's just a great opportunity to be able to mention them and really rejoice in their merits and what they passed on to me. And I suppose I feel like I'm part of that lineage, in terms of passing on Kalyana Mitrata in the team-based right livelihood situation. Yes. So getting to know the movement and the order is really, really of great benefit if you want to take your practice deeper, especially in Tri Ratna, and if you kind of want a bit of a warts and all kind of view, I'd say work with somebody intensively for a period and you'll get much more sense of what spiritual practice in life and work is really about. So we need those people more experienced in Dharma practice to help and support us in our practice. So those Dhammacharinis in the Cambridge store, they just really, really, really held me in. I came here to, a turmoil of doubts and fears, very unintegrated, not much clue really what I was doing all of a sudden in this intense situation that I wasn't quite sure what I'd got myself into. They just really steadily stood by me, stacking shelves, serving customers. It's just really simple. Yeah, really simple. and somehow very, very beautiful. In a way, their faith was just so much more unshakable, and that just really gave me confidence to take my practice deeper, and to ask for ordination, and to continue to work towards ordination, and to get ordained, and to deepen my practice in the Tree Ratna movement. So, another thing I wanted to talk about is what sets team-based right livelihood apart from other workplaces. For me, is the ideal to relate to each other in regards to our spiritual potential and our spiritual aspirations, rather than regarding each other only as in our functions and roles. So in evolution, I've kind of been brought up, our training and in Windhorse, our training was that we don't operate in a strict hierarchy. You know, we don't really fall back on roles and functions and status. Early on in the shop, there was, I think Shantacity was a team leader, but I'm not really sure if she really took on that title. So hierarchy is not really kind of... or wasn't really kind of mapped out. You know, kind of, and I'd see this as an expression really of operating in the love mode rather than the power mode. So I'm just going to quote Subhuti again. If our movement is simply based on impersonal connections between people and roles and status and functions, then it isn't really a spiritual movement at all. It's simply an organisation, and relationships will be increasingly based upon power, upon authority, rules, and so forth. And what lifts us out of this is Kalyanamitrata. So for me, this is the real human dimension of team-based right livelihood. It's really trying to see each other as people, spiritual beings, no matter what our roles in the business. So whether... somebody's my manager or I'm their manager, whether we're in a disciplinary situation, whatever it might be, that, you know, kind of first and foremost, we are humans and have spiritual potential. We have the need to be respected and appreciated in the work that we do and the part that we play in the collective goal. Of course, we need to have roles and rules in the business, and in this world of ever-increasing legislation, we need to be aware of and adhere to things like employment law and health and safety standards. You know, there's no getting around that. But I find this a real area of practice. I'm sure many of you, kind of not in team-based right livelihood, probably find this quite a practice. Sometimes in our business meeting, somebody will mention an issue and it'll be like, oh no, not another policy. You know, I can just feel another policy coming on. you know, kind of, for me, that can take away to some degree the spirit of things. But with Windhorse growing, legislation changing, and we've made a move from being a fully a business fully staffed by Buddhists to employing people who aren't necessarily Buddhists, it has become increasingly important to have those rules and regulations. This is just a reality. So it's been really interesting seeing how things have changed over the years. You know, the days of taking my support money from the till on a Friday afternoon, no recording or anything, just on trust, are well and truly over. And Amaya's probably very happy about that as well. in some ways, you know, more organisation and systems is a really good thing. It's simplified a lot of things. But the reason I resist more policies is that I would prefer not to have to rely on them and to treat situations that arise individually. But the reality is that the managers and staff of our shops, both Buddhist and non-Buddhist, they really want to know what they can do to do their job better. So they want to know how they can do their job the best that they can. Many are used to working for companies that rely on the power mode, you know, and you know, it is just rules and regulations. And without those guidelines, they often don't really know where they stand, or they make up their own policies that may not be in line with our ethos. So I've realised that it's kinder to our staff to be clear in as many areas that we can, and to make policies to support them to do their job better. And for me, kind of, that does feel like a kind of a flow of Kalyanamitrata, taking care of people, You know, I don't ever really want to rely on one rule for all situations. So then the task is then to infuse those policies with our ethos of treating people as human beings and relating to them as individuals, not as a generic customer or a generic staff member. So I find it's really important to keep this spirit of humanness alive despite all the policies and procedures. So again, our practice of ethics is a large part of working in team-based rate livelihood, and this is where our spiritual friends can really help us out. So, you know, in our work we come up against ethical dilemmas every day. You know, how truthful are we? Are we happy to gossip about somebody? Do we stay up too late and struggle to wake up in the morning and be late for work? Are we mindful of the space we share and keep it tidy? You know, does our grumpiness spill over, kind of, to our colleagues? So we can all think of many, many more. I think eventually in team-based rate livelihood, any ethical areas kind of will be challenged, either through feedback from our lovely spiritual friends, you know, kind of our spiritual friend acting as a manager, or through our experience of, you know, kind of feeling that shame of letting our spiritual friends down when we realise that habitually we're doing something habitually. So I'm not going to go into that area too much, because I do really want to talk about cultivating Kalyanamitrata relationships. I think it's just so much easier when we actually spend a lot of time together. And I think that's what the team-based right livelihood situation really, really, really offers. Arta Priya says of team-based right livelihood, shared experience leads to a deepening appreciation of one another, and it's from this deep connection with one another that lasting friendship grows. So Bhante was talking about this in his in a talk, the same talk, I think, his friendship with Dado Rinpoche. He said they'd known each other for quite a while in Kalimpong. They were quite friendly. But it wasn't actually until they were invited on the same lecture tour that they actually really became friends, because they spent day and night together for, I don't know how long the tour was, but it was for quite a long time. They sat next to each other on the bus. And he said that was a real turning point in their relationship and their friendship. He very heartily says in that talk that if you want to be friends with somebody, then live with them. And I'm sure he would also say work with them. But he says it can often be a gradual process. It's not going to happen overnight. It will take time. But if you cooperate and work together, it will happen, he says. So, you know, we really, really spend a lot of time at work, you know, if we're working full time. So what a great opportunity to make spiritual friends. I think I would agree with Bhante that it really does take time to happen. Doesn't happen overnight. And I think I would agree with what Arta Priya says about shared experience, really, really forming that connection. So my experience of working with people over the years is that you really, really take them into your heart. Well, I have. I've really taken people into my heart, you know, quite fully. You know, even if you don't particularly get on, maybe even more so if you don't particularly get on, and you've got a lot to work on and a lot to work through. You know, it's not just that you're hanging out together, you're at work. So there's a lot to be engaging on together. You need to cooperate on many tasks. You need to agree the best ways to do that. You need to make policies together. You really need to get to know people. You get to know people, the good days, the bad days, the difficult times, you know, the days when you need cake, you know, kind of all those days. So, yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk is because I feel really, really fortunate at the moment to be part of, you know, quite, for me, I think, quite an amazing team. The retail team is my best experience of team-based right livelihood. It's probably because, you know, kind of I've integrated to some degree enough to really enjoy it. You know, poor Dhammacharinis in early evolution days. But I think the reason is that some of us have been working directly together now for 5 or 6 years, and we've known each other in the business or through the business connections for up to 10 years. And this just builds an amazing amount of shared history together. And we've seen a lot of experience together. So we've built a lot of trust and support. So I'm often really moved by what we actually achieve together. And I there's a real love, I think, of the way that we work together. Yes, it is quite magical at times. And I sometimes feel that the people I'm working with are more my Dharma brothers and sisters, you know, most definitely than my work colleagues. It's a very familial kind of feeling in my kind of, in how I relate to them. The retail team, the title of this talk is With a Little Help from My Friends. And it was something that Jana Schalen mentioned in a meeting we were having the other day. He was talking about just how he could do his job better. And, you know, he said, oh, yeah, with a little help from my friends, you know, blah, blah, blah. So when I had to think of a title, I just remembered him saying that. Because I think that's my experience of my team at the moment, is that, you know, with a little help from my friends, as I was saying earlier, you know, the collective situation can actually really bring something much, much bigger to life than kind of what we can do individually. And I suppose I've been really thinking about more the collective nature of Kalyanamitrata. You know, if that kind of really exists. I think we can think of Kalyanamitrata as kind of, you know, it's from this person to this person to this person. You know, it's kind of either, you know, it's a vertical. So I'm thinking about Kalyanamitrata more as something that in team-based right livelihood for me really permeates a team and those of us kind of working together. So as part of what I've been thinking about in relation to that is how through that collective practice we can kind of move into that more magical realm of the transcendental. So Subhuti recently spent 2 days in seminar with some of us from Windhorse, the Windhorse Management Forum, and he was really clear in saying that what we really needed to focus on in team-based right livelihood in our practice was loosening our sense of ego identity. So he said we should be really challenging our fixed sense of identity, and our practice should be leading us to seeing through our fixed sense of self. And in his booklet recently published, The Suprapersonal Force, he says the crucial transition in Dharma life is a movement from a self-oriented view to a selfless motivation. So he goes on to say that selfless does not mean lacking in self, not a blank automaton. Selflessness has its own positive nature, a function of a fully mature awareness. A need is seen and responded to in the most appropriate way, without any personal interest, without a moment's premeditation, spontaneously responding to what is objectively needed. And I just thought, the Aniruddhas. You know, I don't know if everybody knows that Aniruddhas, most people may, but I'll just briefly, they're often evoked as a kind of ideal of spiritual friendship, and they are a model that I've kind of taken on as inspiration in my work at Windhorse. And Deborah's going to do a reading in the puja, so if you haven't heard it before, she'll definitely be reading that in the puja. So I won't go into it too much, but they're three disciples. The Aniruddhas are three disciples of the Buddha. They live together, they collect their alms together, they practice together, and they do this mainly in silence. And about every fifth night, they say they get together and have a chat about the Dharma. So the Buddha kind of asks them about their practice. And basically, in a nutshell, part of what they talk about is they just see what needs to be done, and they just do what needs to get done. And I think that's something that I've just really taken up in team-based right livelihood. And I'm not explaining it very well because I'm running out a bit of time, but hopefully those of you who do know what I'm talking about can get a sense of it. I think in a really good team, a really kind of well-oiled team with good systems that run quite smoothly, things can actually get done with little discussion. Everybody plays their part in doing what they need to do. You know, kind of there's a sense of not having to... what are we doing? We're just kind of, well, for me, I've taken on as a practice of just doing what needs to be done without kind of making a big song and dance about it. You know, kind of no drama, kind of just doing what the actual job requires or what, you know, kind of is required in the moment. And I think they are an example of what Subhuti is talking about in terms of a fully functioning awareness. So in a way, we've gone to the lofty realms here of the ideal. But I do feel that there are traces of this in our lives and that we can loosen our ego identity through practice to experience a flavour of this. So another theme that's quite close to my heart is the bodhicitta, or the will to enlightenment. It's said to arise, it's more likely to arise in a collective situation. And the example of the Lichavi youths, thousands of them with their parasols, is often a symbol of the bodhicitta. So thousands of people with individual parasols, they open them up to create one big canopy. Something emerges from the individual collective practice of those individuals to make something bigger, something transcendental. So there, these thousands of parasols unite to create one parasol. For me, it's a powerful image of our collective practice, uniting to create something bigger. And the bodhicitta is a flow of ever-increasing selfless mental states. So I've recently had quite a strong experience of something like this in the workplace happening. I just wanted to kind of share that with you all. I mean, the situation was my team had been meeting very, very, very intensively. We'd been in this branding process, and we'd all been sharing very freely. Sometimes we'd been disagreeing. Sometimes we were questioning each other to understand the point that they were making. But we were very, very, very focused. And I had the sense that we were all very, very present. And the intensity just seemed to be building. And then at some point we came to a natural kind of pause. And something just seemed to, everybody just kind of seemed to relax and reflect for a minute. And then there was just this moment, this space. I don't know what happened, but something opened up. And in my mind I just thought, this is where the bodhicitta arises. I don't really know kind of what that was, but there was, for me, it's definitely the kind of the motivation, the momentum of our practice, sharing together. And I think what was really significant about that moment was it really felt like there were no egos in the room. We were all just really focused on what was best for the business. And it was just a really, really, really beautiful thing. And it's very, very hard to kind of talk about. And in a way, that's really all I really would have liked to have shared with you. But I made up a talk around it. Some of it not quite fitting together. There might be about 5 or 6 talks in here, I think. I am really moved by my team at the moment. I'm just aware of time. But I wanted to show you something else that we'd been working on that kind of, I think, comes out of our practice, our friendship together, how we work together in this intensity. We get to know each other, and then we can make something that is much bigger than what we could make on our own. So I'll just wait for that to connect. But the team was, we were working towards Wesak, and we wanted to build a shrine. So we went on retreat. And we built individual shrines. Okay, let's just hope this will work. Hey, there we go. Oops. Yeah. So each of us built individual shrines. This was mine. We all had an afternoon. This was Dan. He screen printed all of that in an afternoon. It was beautiful. This is Tom. I can't see it so well, but he bought it kind of, is pretty much replicated his shrine at home. This is Jams. Very mysterious. He had to go in there. Lots of elements of the sea, rope and shells and things. This was Sam's. She'd just bought a new rupa. This was Sam's kind of expression of her practice. Yana Shalin, very Zen. And James, he went for the outdoor shrine. He decided just to use everything. He only used natural things from where the place we were staying. So I just felt really, really, really moved by all of our individual shrines and by the individuality, you know, kind of our practice expressed through making these shrines, you know, kind of an expression of our going for refuge in a way. And then the idea was to take those shrines and make one shrine, which could be, you know, a very, very difficult process trying to get consensus and agree on how you make a shrine. But what I'm really moved by is we just did it. It just happened. I think our years of working together, there's an ease of communication in that made it just really easy. And it was just like magic. It just manifested. And the next thing we knew... These aren't fantastic photographs, but we created this shrine with just elements from everybody's shrine. So we had kind of the leaves and the air element from Jan's shrine. We had the little cards and sayings from Sam's shrine. Sam got the kusa grass from Norfolk. James bought the rocks all the way from Sheffield. You know, kind of Dan painted the tree. It's really lovely, subtle tree. It's got the kind of like Zen kind of simplicity of Yana Shalin's shrine. And it's got my Buddha and it's kind of the colourings of my Buddha there. And for me, it's just a really, really powerful image of what we can do collectively, working together in team-based right livelihood. And that's what I wanted to talk about tonight. So thank you.